Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What really happened to Egypt's Tutankhamun after he died? We can't do more than speculate about the fate of the boy king's soul, but his body is another matter entirely. After resting peacefully and forgotten for more than 3,000 years, Tut's corporeal remains have been excavated, dismembered, inspected, and argued over for the past 90. So what can modern science and scholarship tell us for certain about the life of this inscrutable figure from our ancient past, and what mysteries will remain unsolved for eternity? Science journalist Jo Marchant takes on these questions in her new book, The Shadow King, The Bizarre Afterlife of King Tut's Mummy. Jo, welcome to Think.
Hi, thanks for having me.
How did modern people first start excavating for treasure in Egypt?
There were a couple of early explorers. So in the 19th century, people just started turning things up. There were mummies everywhere. There were stone kind of remains of temples and statues that the sort of locals hadn't really paid very much attention to. And it suddenly became big business. Everybody was from the Europe and the US. People were heading there, seeing what they could find. It became a big treasure hunt. Everyone was bringing home mummies. That's kind of how it all started. I mean, it was a bit of a frenzy, really.
And at the time, there was a sort of finders keepers ethos and no restrictions on what could be taken out of the country after it was discovered.
That's right. You could just pretty much go and take whatever you wanted. It was that kind of colonial mindset that the archaeology wasn't really seen as a science at the time, and the politics were very different. So people would just go in and take home whatever they found.
So we know that lots of ancient sites were, to use modern parlance, frankly, looted, and you know, things were put in museums or they were put up for sale. What factors kept Tut's tomb concealed for such a long time?
Had it concealed for such a long time?
Yeah. Why was it hidden from? Why were people unable to find it for such a long time?
Oh, I see. Basically, it was to do with flash floods. So Tutankhamun was buried. It's called the Valley of the Kings. So it's this kind of remote valley in the desert of southern Egypt. It's close to the modern-day city of Luxor. So the pharaohs had hoped that their tombs would remain hidden for eternity and wouldn't be able to be looted, but most of them were. They'd already emptied by robbers in ancient times. But you do get occasional flash floods in that area, which just carry sort of rock and rubble down from the mountains, and it all kind of sweeps down through this valley and just covers everything. This basically happened a few years after Tutankhamun was buried and just covered his tomb completely so that it was lost and forgotten about, and that's why it was then untouched for more than 3,000 years until it was discovered in 1922.
Okay, so how did Howard Carter go about the process of excavating it? This is not a small job.
It took him years. So a lot of other royal tombs had been discovered in the Valley of the Kings at this point by other people, but they had almost all been they were almost all empty. They had been sort of looted in antiquity. And most people who'd been looking there said they thought the valley was empty. You know, all of its treasures had been found. And Howard Carter was determined. There were various little clues that he picked up, and he was determined that he thought that Tutankhamun's tomb was going to be found there. And he spent 6 years looking for it, just moving mountains and mountains of rubble, just clearing the valley right down to bedrock just to try and just make sure that he hadn't missed anything. And then after 6 seasons, his men uncovered a stone step, which was their first signal that there was a tomb down there.
It's amazing to think what that must have felt like.
Yeah, I mean, he writes about it in his diary, saying that it was a thrilling moment for an excavator, I think, are words that he used. It was an incredible vindication for him. He was working with the Earl of Carnarvon, who was paying for the work that he was doing. The Earl had tried to sort of pull out the year before, wanted to withdraw his money and go and do something else instead. And Howard Carter had convinced him to try for one last season. So it must have been incredible to finally find what he'd been looking for so long.
Of course, poor Lord Carnarvon famously and very suddenly died not long after the tomb was opened, which caused people at the time to talk about a curse on the tomb.
Yeah, that's right. He was bitten by a mosquito, and it seems that the bite became infected, and in those days he didn't have any antibiotics, so he died a few weeks later. And this caused a huge storm over the curse, At the time in the 1920s, spiritualism was quite popular. People were very into seances and the idea of sort of spirits from beyond the grave trying to communicate with us. That was quite popular. So I think the idea of a curse kind of fitted in with that, and also journalists were desperate for stories about Tutankhamun. So by this point, a few months after the tomb had been discovered, all these incredible treasures had been discovered, but that was starting to slow down a bit, so they were desperate for stories too.
What kinds of measures were taken during the excavation process to protect the site and keep people from sort of getting in the middle of the night?
There was an iron door that Carter ordered from Cairo. The entrance to the tomb was kind of sealed off and bolted with that. And they had guards around the clock as well.
But they couldn't keep the bats out.
No, apparently they couldn't keep the bats out. So initially, before he got a solid door, for a few months it was just bars across. Much later on there was a theory about the curse that it might have been a fungus that lives in bat guano, this particular fungus had killed several people in southern Africa who'd gone into caves where there was a lot of bat guano. So cavers, a scientist became very ill, and there were some witch doctor ceremonies as well where people would go down into the caves if they wanted to be a witch doctor, and some of them would die, and the ones that didn't became witch doctors. And it was all traced back to this particular fungus, and there was a theory that perhaps this had been in Tutankhamun's tomb and was what finished off Lord Carnarvon. And actually, when investigations were made, it turned out that, yes, bats had been roosting inside the tomb after it was opened by Howard Carter before he got this solid door. I'm not sure there would have been enough bat guano to give the Earl a sort of high enough dose of this fungus to kill him, but, you know, it is possible.
So we know that there was just crazy media reaction following the unveiling of the tomb. What do you think excited people so much about this discovery?
There were several different factors. Nothing like this had been found before. This was an intact royal tomb, absolutely filled with treasure, thousands of items, everything you can imagine. Jewelry, shoes, weapons, chariots, thrones, statues, vases, children's toys. Just everything, and just incredibly beautifully made. So the treasure has to be part of it. His coffins as well. His inner coffin was solid gold, and it was a huge amount of the metal. So I think that just really stunned people. Nobody had seen before this how the Egyptians buried their pharaohs, because the other tombs were all empty, and it just blew people's minds what was coming out of the tomb. And then, of course, you've got this curse story that really took off as well. So there's kind of that mystery of were their guards, were their spirits guarding the tomb. But also there was the sort of historical interest as well. Many people at the time really saw the ancient Egyptians as the founders of civilization. It's not quite how we see history today, but it was people were just really excited by this ancient civilization, and they were seeing the temples and the hieroglyphics and all of the stuff that's coming out of ancient Egypt. And also, this is the same time period and part of the world that is described in the Old Testament of the Bible, parts of it, and you've got figures such as Joseph and Moses who were described as being close to the Egyptian royal family. So for people in Europe and the US, for example, it was incredibly exciting to be uncovering remains that might sort of shed light on some of the stories that were in the Bible as well.
So what extant records of Tut's life existed beyond the things that were discovered in the tomb? Are there sort of additional sources that can tell us about him?
Yes, but not very much. So when this tomb was discovered, Tutankhamun was known about, but not much was known about him. He comes from quite an interesting period in ancient Egyptian history. So it's the end of the 18th dynasty, which is one of the sort of most rich and powerful dynasties in ancient Egypt. This was around 1300 BC, so around 3,300 years ago. And so this was a bit later than the Egyptians were building the Great Pyramids that everyone's heard of near Cairo. So by this time, the royal family had moved south, and they, instead of burying themselves in these pyramids, they had these tombs in the Valley of the Kings. And there was this pharaoh called Akhenaten, who was a real revolutionary. The ancient Egyptians had the same religion for centuries, and they had their sort of set of gods, and this got passed down, you know, every king's, you know, the religion stayed the same, until he decided that he was going to throw all of that out and simply worship the sun disk, just one god. So he's often called the world's first known monotheist. And he also abandoned the traditional capital city of Thebes and moved into the desert and built his own capital city from scratch. And all that was really known about Tutankhamun was that he came just after this and appears to have reversed all of those changes. There was a stone slab from Tutankhamun's reign where he talks about how he threw all of this out and reinstated the traditional capital city and the traditional religion. And there are a couple of other sort of little mentions, but that was pretty much all that was known. And he just seems to have died shortly afterwards without leaving any heirs. And pretty soon after that, that was the end of the 18th dynasty, and a new dynasty beginning with Ramesses the First had begun. So, not much was known about him.
Well, what's so fascinating about, you know, Tut coming in and then deciding, okay, we're going to go back to this, you know, pantheon of gods, is that he took the throne around age 9. Is that right?
Yeah, so this wasn't known before the tomb was found, but when they unwrapped the body of, when they unwrapped his mummy, they found that he died young. He died at about 18. And we know from records inside the tomb, among other things, sort of wine containers, which have the sort of year of the vintage is kind of done in the number of years that the king has reigned. So we know that he reigned for about 9 years and he died at age 18. So, yes, he must have taken the throne very, very young, around the age of 9.
So the question is it likely that that power, those decisions were his, or that there were other people sort of guiding his rule?
Yeah, so that has caused a lot of interest. And it seems that if he was so young, there must have been people around him that were making those decisions for him. And there have been a lot of theories about, you know, because he died so young, it's like, you know, the idea that he might have been murdered has been a very popular one. So were there sort of different people kind of vying for the power and different factions? Maybe there were some who, you know, supported Akhenaten's kind of regime, and there were others who wanted to bring Egypt back to its traditional ways. So it's kind of a very dramatic but murky period in history.
So, Joe, you mentioned that the autopsy on his body, the initial autopsy, helped to confirm what his age was at the time of death. And there's really no way to describe this initial procedure other than brutal.
Yeah, I mean, that's the way we would see it today, at least. I mean, I suppose you have to judge it by the standards of the time. But, the body was pretty fragile. It wasn't in great condition. There was great hopes that the body would be in pristine condition because it was, you know, the tomb was intact. But actually, large quantities of sort of unguents and resins and oil had been poured over it at the time of the burial, and there was a bit of dampness in the coffin as well. So those two things, over thousands of years, had caused the body to become quite charred. Also, these unguents had set absolutely solid and basically glued the mummy into this solid gold coffin and glued the famous golden burial mask that was pretty much glued onto the mummy and onto the coffin as well. So to get these things apart, they cut the mummy into pieces, basically. They had to take it out piece by piece. They scraped it out with hot knives. So, yes, that was pretty brutal.
My guest is science journalist Joe Marchant. Her new book is called The Shadow King, The Bizarre Afterlife of King Tut's Mummy. If you've got a question, you can call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration opens on August 6th. Catalogs can be requested at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is science journalist Jo Marchant. Her new book is called The Shadow King, The Bizarre Afterlife of King Tut's Mummy. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can send email to think@kera.org, or you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. Jo, just by way of comparison, when we talk about the initial autopsy that was done in 1925, how would a procedure like that be conducted today if such a relic were unearthed? And sort of what precautions would be taken to preserve the integrity of the remains themselves?
Well, I've seen a lot of cases it wouldn't actually be unwrapped at all. So that there's much more of a move now in archaeology to sort of non-invasive techniques. So they would be using CT scanning, X-rays, that kind of thing, to see what's inside the mummy, to unwrap it virtually, if you like. Actually, in the case of Tutankhamun, it's difficult to say if that would actually happen, because just the amount of treasures, the value of the jewelry, hundreds of items of jewelry on the body, and also the coffin. But I think it's safe to say that the entire thing with the coffin, the mummy, and the mask would have been taken probably to a sort of state-of-the-art lab where, if he was unwrapped to retrieve the jewelry, it would have been done extremely carefully. I mean, Howard Carter and his colleagues did the best they could at the time. They spent 8 days unwrapping the mummy, and they took photographs at every stage. It was very meticulous, very scientific, and that was actually quite revolutionary for the time. Previous raw mummies that had been found, I mean, some of them were unwrapped in as little as 15 minutes and no photographs taken. It was completely unscientific. So I think we do have to give Carter some credit for doing the best that he could, with the techniques that he had available.
So given the information available and what people knew at the time, what were the initial conclusions drawn about Tut's body, the state of it, and what had likely killed him?
Fairly limited. So, yes, there was the age, which we've discussed. So you can tell by looking at the ends of the limb bones, particularly. A lot of them hadn't fused, suggesting that he was still growing. So that from that, they got an age of 18. And he was a fairly slight figure, as I guess you would expect for that age. They didn't find any obvious wounds or cause of death. So Howard Carter was quite disappointed about that. He really had hoped for some hint at the cause of death. But they did find that Tutankhamun had an extremely wide skull. And that was interesting because another anonymous pharaoh's mummy had been found in a nearby tomb dating from around the same time, which also had an extremely wide skull. And these two skulls were almost identical. So that suggested that these two figures were very closely related. So that was quite an interesting piece of information.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Lee in Denton. Hi, Lee.
Hi, how's it going?
Great, thank you.
Hi.
Well, thanks for taking my call. My question, I've watched the History Channel, a special on Tutankhamun, and they had remarked that the sarcophagus was very feminine, that the painting on it looked very feminine, and they said that it was possible that part of the conspiracy with his death involved, his mother. And, you mentioning now about even finding another, monarch or whatever, pharaoh, right next to him, made me think maybe there's some relation there. But I was wondering if you had any kind of follow-up on that or had heard that, can speak to that.
A little bit. So, I mean, I'm not an Egyptologist, and this is getting more into the Egyptology and sort of the relics that were found in the tomb. So my expertise is more to do with the science and the studies that have been done on the mummy. So I'll kind of say that as a disclaimer to start off with. But there do seem to have been, so I mentioned Akhenaten, and there seem to have been perhaps one or two very short-lived pharaohs in between Akhenaten and Tutankhamun, whose mummies haven't been found, but this is from sort of paintings on tomb walls and different sources of evidence like that. And there are different theories about them. So there is a man called Smen Kare, who people wonder if he might be this anonymous pharaoh that I was talking about, who was found in a tomb called KV-55, or some people think the anonymous pharaoh is Akhenaten, so there's a big argument over that. But also there seems to have been a predecessor that people argue about whether this was actually a woman who was reigning as a king. Some people even think that this was Nefertiti, who was Akhenaten's wife, who perhaps ruled after Akhenaten died. And so there's nothing certain known about that, but that's a theory that some Egyptologists have. And indeed, some of the relics from Tutankhamun's tomb, so one of his coffins, or there are some other items that have faces that look feminine, some statues of Tutankhamun. So there's this theory that Tutankhamun had some sort of weird gender disorder, that he had breasts because some of these statues of him look very feminine. But other Egyptologists argue that actually, no, these aren't of him at all. These are of his predecessor, this woman. So it's very murky and it's not clear, but there may well have been a woman ruler involved.
So in terms of establishing family relationships and other people found in the Valley of the Kings, of course, the body was entirely desiccated. So you have a challenge if you're trying to look at even something like blood type. But some very clever scientists found a way around this problem.
So this is coming forward to the 1960s now. So after Carter's autopsy in 1925, nobody looked at the mummy again until 1968, when an anatomist from Liverpool University in England, he x-rayed the mummy, but he also took a little sample home with him. It's still there in Liverpool, in a little plastic tube, the remains of it. So they wanted to test for the blood group, because the molecules on our cells that determine some kinds of blood group aren't just on blood cells, they're on all the cell types, many of the cell types in the body. So they would have been on skin cells as well, for example. But the sample was too small to do the normal test that you would do to determine somebody's blood group. So what they did was they isolated the sort of the molecules off the mummy's cells and then mixed them with modern human blood to stick to those cells, in effect kind of bringing the blood type back to life. That then gave them a bigger sample to test, and they said they tested Tutankhamun's blood type and found that it was so in the ABO sort of blood grouping that most people have heard of. He was group A and A2. Actually, it's a type of A called A2. That was a pretty cunning study, and they got a paper in the sort of top science journal Nature out of that.
And did that blood typing actually reveal anything important about Tut's lineage?
On its own, it didn't, but they also tested this anonymous pharaoh that I've mentioned, the one from Tomb KV 55, and he had the identical blood group. So that was just sort of extra evidence, really. Sort of the skull was kind of circumstantial. This is circumstantial too, but you put the two together, and it seems pretty certain that these two were very closely related, father and son perhaps, or brothers.
So there were people who thought that there had been like aliens buried with King Tut. It turns out there were fetuses in the tomb with him.
Yeah, that's right. It's kind of a tragic story, really. But in one of the side rooms, there was a box, and inside the box, these two tiny little coffins, and stuffed inside those were these miniature mummies. They had been mummified, and embalmed with all the sort of care that Tutankhamun was. But they turned out to be two female fetuses, estimated to be around sort of 5 and 8 months gestation.
Hmm. And no explanation as to who they were?
No names or sort of anything like that on them. And the assumption is that they were Tutankhamun's stillborn daughters. I mean, it's possible that they, perhaps could have been put in there for some other kind of religious or symbolic reason, but it seems more likely that they would have had some close connection with him. In that same room was also found a lock of hair from his grandmother, or she's probably his grandmother, Queen Tai. So there was, that was sort of family member and a kind of sort of heirloom that was there with him. So, it seems that there must have been some kind of strong relationship between these two little girls and the king.
How long would it have taken after a king died to prepare the tomb in the fashion that the Tuts was? I mean, would it have been a matter of years, of decades?
It depends on the sort of size of the tomb and the length of the reign of the king. So the longer the king lived, because they would generally start preparing and digging the tomb fairly, not immediately after they took the throne, but fairly soon. Mm-hmm. And so if a king ruled for decades, he would have this enormous tomb. Whereas Tutankhamun, died unexpectedly quite young. So it's not clear whether, the tomb that was meant for him had even been started. There's, an idea that actually, his tomb, a lot of people sort of see signs that perhaps it was prepared quite hastily. It's much smaller than your normal royal tomb would be. Only the burial chamber has got any paintings on the walls. The others are bare. And even the paintings that are there look fairly hastily done. There's fungus spots that once sort of grew on those on those paintings suggesting that there was some moisture. In other words, the paintings weren't quite dry when the tomb was sealed. So all of these sort of signs are saying that actually this was done in a big rush. So it would have taken weeks for the mummy to be prepared, so they would have had that amount of time. But it seems that, it would have been a race against time to get the tomb ready for him.
Hmm. Where is Tut's heart?
Sorry, say that again?
Where is the heart of King Tut?
That's an interesting question. So it's fairly well known that the ancient Egyptian embalmers took out most of the organs of the body when they prepared a mummy, and the key ones were put in these jars and buried sort of next to the mummy. But the Egyptians always left the heart in place. That was very important to them. Sort of one of their beliefs was that when the spirit is traveling into the afterlife, the heart will be weighed to see whether you lived a good life or not, and there are all these spells to make sure that your heart says the right thing and you get your passage into the afterlife. So they always left the heart in place, but Tutankhamun's mummy doesn't have a heart. So Carter didn't know this when he did his autopsy, but the subsequent x-rays and CT scans have shown this. So, it's a mystery. Has the heart been stolen? Was it taken out before he was embalmed for some reason? Did he suffer a big injury in which his sort of chest and the heart were sort of damaged and destroyed? Personally, I think that the evidence points to that more than the other explanations. But yes, it's very interesting where his heart might be.
All right, so let's talk about injury. Okay, so there have been theories like, you know, Tut was in a chariot accident, Tut was attacked by a rogue hippo, Tut was murdered. Is there any indication that he suffered a violent death?
It's so hard to tell. If you imagine that this body, I mean, first of all, the process of mummification is a pretty violent one. You know, all the sort of internal organs are taken out, mm-hmm. You know, the body is sort of dried out with salts, all these, oils rubbed into it and bandaged. So that's a lot of damage is going to happen to the body in that process. Then you've got 3,300 years that it was in the tomb. Then you've got this brutal autopsy. There's also evidence that the body was kind of ransacked and looted at some point between it being put back into the tomb in 1926 and it next being opened in 1968. Then you've got a whole series of scientific studies that have been carried out on it. So if you imagine the body's been through all of that and then you look at it and see damage, a broken bone or something, how on earth do you know if that happened in Tutankhamun's life or if it happened in one of these stages since his death? So that has been the problem all along. And every study that's done pretty much finds a different sort of piece of damage to the mummy that gets turned into the next new theory about how Tutankhamun died in this generally a TV documentary to accompany it, and we get this dramatic headline until the next study, and then there's a new piece of damage and a new theory and a new headline. So really, it's impossible to know for sure. I mean, some of the theories have been definitely debunked, and we can talk about those. But unfortunately, it's not possible at this point to say for sure how he died.
Okay, what do we know did not... We know his skull was not crushed while he was alive?
So that was one of the sort of very persistent myths about Tutankhamun. So that came from this x-ray study in 1968 that I mentioned. So Ronald Harrison, this professor of anatomy, announced to the BBC television, the British television cameras, that he had seen a double line in the x-ray at the base of Tutankhamun's skull. And he thought that this was a sort of membrane that had formed over a hemorrhage at the base of the skull that could have been caused by a blow to the back of the head, and that could have been what killed him. And this became worldwide headline news, newspaper headlines in every language, talking about how this was proof that Tutankhamun had been murdered. And best-selling books have been written about this theory. But actually, it turned out that it was just because the body was at a slight angle when the head was x-rayed. So you see the two sides of the base of the skull. One appears slightly above the other, and that's what gave you this double line. So it was an artifact of the imaging process. Nothing wrong with his skull whatsoever, unfortunately.
It also seems that he was not, like, born with massive deformations, right? He seems to have had a pretty normal body, as far as we can tell.
Yes, I would say so. So this is something that scientists argue about as well. So the initial autopsy and then the x-rays in 1968, he seemed to be perfectly healthy. He's got an impacted wisdom tooth, but other than that, seemed well-nourished, healthy, teeth in good condition, no obvious deformities. But there was a CT scanning study carried out by an Egyptian team in 2005, and this was filmed by National Geographic for documentary. So all of this work is funded by television companies, so it's all featured in documentaries. And initially, they thought he was fine. They did see a broken thigh bone, which they thought was maybe related to his death. But then subsequently, those CT scans were reanalyzed, and a paper was published claiming that actually he had he did have some deformities. He had a club foot was the main thing. He had a missing bone in his toe, and he had a club foot, so he would have walked sort of with a stick. He would have been a cripple, essentially. You know, he would have limped with a stick. And so more headlines about this. But I'm really not convinced about that. I spoke to a lot of experts about these CT scans, and most of the other experts I spoke to didn't think that there was any evidence that he had this. Like, so the foot is slightly curled up, but that could easily have been just the way, you know, when the foot was bandaged, you know, during the mummification process. And the missing toe bone, there's actually a sort of, there's open damage to the foot in that place, so the bone could easily have fallen out. And actually, when I went to the archives of Ronald Harrison, who studied the body in the 1960s, so he didn't publish this, but he sort of wrote in his sort of private correspondence that the same left foot, he actually spoke to people in Egypt who had been present during Carter's study and said that Carter actually took a blow lamp to this foot because he wanted to melt the resin and get a sample of the resin. So that, again, could easily explain some of the damage to the foot. So I think personally that there isn't any evidence that he was a cripple. He seems to have been quite a healthy young man.
My guest is science journalist Jo Marchant. Her new book is called The Shadow King, The Bizarre Afterlife of King Tut's Mummy. We'll resume our conversation in a couple of minutes. And if you'd like to join us, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration opens on August 6th. Catalogs can be requested at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is science journalist Jo Marchant. Her new book is called The Shadow King, The Bizarre Afterlife of King Tut's Mummy. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or by emailing think@kera.org. So, Jo, you mentioned that, you know, all of these, this ongoing research very often is funded by people who want to make television documentaries. What sort of tension is there between the people who want to make these splashy films and the sort of academic researchers who want to understand the scientific and historical significance of these remains?
Well, I guess if you asked them, they would say that there isn't any tension and it's all fine. But I think it's inevitable that you do get some sort of pull between wanting to do a sort of careful, thorough job of the science and the fact that there aren't always clear answers. And sometimes it takes a long time to get results, and sometimes those results are ambiguous, and different people are going to interpret the data differently, especially as we've talked about how difficult it is to know anything for sure when you're looking at such a kind of battered, remains mm-hmm. That are so old. And obviously the TV companies, you know, they're investing millions of dollars into some of these studies. The CT study I talked about and more recent DNA tests, I mean, these cost millions, and Egypt doesn't have the money to do that research. So it's companies like Discovery and National Geographic who are funding those. So, you know, clearly they want some return on that. They want, naturally, big, dramatic headlines. They want them quickly. You know, they want the kind of certain stories that are going to appeal to people. And, you know, those two things, you know, they don't sit together very easily, in my opinion.
How and when did Egypt begin to reclaim ownership of its ancient treasures and to forbid the removal of any more artifacts from the country?
Well, this was sort of starting to happen in the 1920s already, when Carter found Tutankhamun's tomb. I mean, so Britain had occupied Egypt and gave Egypt sort of nominal independence. The British were sort of still, the military was still there, and they were still in charge of a lot of things. But Egypt was starting to assert its independence at that point, and there were real tensions between Carter and the Antiquities Service, for example. They both locked each other out of the tomb at one point. They were having such arguments about the control of access to the tomb and who was going to end up with the treasures at the end of the day. Before that, archaeologists, you know, they would come in and they would do this work, and there was this kind of unwritten agreement that they could walk off with half of the treasures and Egypt would keep the other half. But from sort of Carter onwards, that really started to change, and all of the artifacts from Tutankhamun's tomb, officially anyway, went to the museum in Cairo, the Egyptian Museum in Cairo. So, and since it's kind of happened gradually since then, so the first time that the Antiquity Service actually had an Egyptian leading it was in the 1950s. The French were sort of in control of it before then. But still at that point, foreign researchers like Harrison in the 1960s could come in. He worked on the mummy, took a sample home with him. More recently, it's been that's become very sort of sensitive. So in the last couple of decades, it's really got tightened up, and there is a real reluctance to foreign researchers can come in and work, but they're not allowed to take anything home with them. So the idea of taking a sample home with you from a royal mummy now, that just wouldn't happen. And actually, in the last few years, especially with something as high profile as the royal mummies, the Egyptians have really not wanted foreigners even to do that work. They've wanted to do it themselves, and you can kind of understand why with the history that they've had. You know, they want ownership of those artifacts, of those studies, and of the data that's produced. As I said, they don't always have the money to do the research, and often they don't have the expertise of the very sort of latest techniques. So that's why you've ended up with this kind of uneasy marriage of the TV companies providing the money so that then the Egyptians can do the work.
How secure are Egypt's antiquities in the current climate of political unrest?
A lot of them, not very. Before the revolution, there was quite a sort of good system, as far as I can work out. You had sort of specialist antiquities police who kept the sites fairly secure. And, you know, there was a feeling that, you know, Egypt needs these antiquities because it's very reliant on the money from tourists mm-hmm. who come to see them. So that they were pretty secure. But from the revolution in January 2011 onwards, there's been real looting of a lot of sites. So I think the main sites in the Valley of the Kings are pretty secure, and the Egyptian Museum in Cairo, although it was looted actually during the revolution, the uprising itself, I think that's pretty secure now. But there are a lot of sites all over Egypt, the ones that we haven't really heard of and the ones in more remote areas, that do seem to be at greater risk of, you know, often there are stories within Egypt, you know, people think that there's gold to be had, they'll go digging, or often they just want to use the land, there's illegal building on the land. So that is something that that hasn't really been got on top of, especially because, you know, there's been so much uncertainty with just who's in charge there.
We have an email here from Lauren in Dallas who says, I know that Tut's remains are almost always on tour. Who now profits from this? And who owns him now? We should say, just to correct Lauren a little bit there, the remains themselves don't travel. Is that right?
That's right. So the mummy itself, he has stayed in his tomb. He was brought out just outside his tomb for the CT scan, got put in the CT scanner back in his tomb. But apart from that, he has stayed in his tomb. But the treasures, there have been several sort of huge touring exhibitions. And the most recent one, they made a model of the mummy with a 3D printer. Have you heard of these 3D printers that
yeah.
can create sort of very lifelike replicas of things? And that's what they did with the mummy. So that 3D replica became the centerpiece of this more recent exhibition in some cities. So that's probably what Lauren is thinking of. But yeah, that's interesting. So the artifacts were all owned by Egypt. But this recent exhibition, for example, they teamed up with National Geographic again and some other media companies who sort of paid for this touring exhibition. And it made huge profits. I think nearly 8 million people worldwide saw this international exhibition of the treasures. And that made hundreds of millions of dollars. I think Egypt itself probably made, Zahi Hawass, who was Antiquities Chief at the time, told me that they made more than $100 million for that. I'm sure National Geographic and the other companies made very large amounts as well. So
he's quite a character, Mr. Hawass.
Yes. So your listeners may be familiar with him. Perhaps they've seen him. He did a lot of stuff for National Geographic and Discovery, always wearing an Indiana Jones hat.
We had him on the show, actually, so he was in the studio, yeah.
He's an incredible, forceful, charismatic, energetic character. I mean, he's really sort of taken ancient Egypt to the world, I think, and got people really interested in it. It's made it very accessible. You know, he's so sort of excited when he's talking about these treasures. Before him, Egyptology, it was kind of an esoteric subject and a bit snobbish as well. And he's, you know, talks in language that people can understand and gets people all around the world excited about it. I mean, he certainly has his critics, but he has, you know, really popularized the whole subject as well.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Mark on the line in Arlington. Hi, Mark.
Hi there. Very fascinating show today. I had a couple of quick questions. One, just wondering, in the course of the research for your book, if you were able to visit the tomb in Egypt and Valley of the Kings. And secondly, kind of a fluff question, wondering about the curse of King Tut and those stories and where all those kind of stories came from back in the day.
Thanks for your call.
Yes, I did visit the tomb during my research for the book. I had been there before just as a tourist years ago, but I revisited last year, actually, February last year. So it was a great time to go because it was after the revolution and so there were no tourists there. And actually down in Luxor, it's very quiet. So I had the tomb to myself apart from the one security guard. So it was really incredible just to be able to be there in a very quiet environment and take it all in. And just a few years ago, they took the mummy. He was in his coffin, so you couldn't actually see the mummy. You could only see this golden coffin. But now they've taken him out, and he's in this glass exhibition case, so you can actually stand there and see the mummy very close up. That was a really interesting experience after having done so much research and investigated all of these stories to actually go there and experience it. In terms of the curse, we talked a bit about... Lord Carnarvon, who'd paid for the discovery of the tomb, died shortly after. And so that really blew up this whole story. And actually, ironically, the ancient Egyptians weren't particularly into the idea of curses. There are a couple of examples on tombs of kind of retribution if you sort of steal bricks from this tomb. But it was generally stuff that would happen to you in the afterlife. This idea of a mummy that is going to come after you really didn't exist for the ancient Egyptians, and that was just something that really seems to have come out of Victorian England. Actually, there was a little-known novelist in the 19th century who wrote the first story that we would recognize as sort of the mummy's curse. So that was kind of there, and then when Carnarvon died, it got kind of jumped on and turned into this big thing. But what I think is really interesting about the curse is that it's changed over the decades. So in the 1920s, people were having serious conversations in the newspapers about whether evil spirits had killed Lord Carnarvon. And now we don't really take that seriously, but in the 1970s, millions of books were sold talking about how it was sophisticated technology from aliens. You know, the tomb was booby-trapped, and that was what was killing people. And then more recently, we've had this idea that it was a sort of toxic fungus, so we've got a bit more scientific about it. And there was even a clinical trial published in the British Medical Journal comparing how long people lived who had been in the tomb and hadn't. So it's definitely become much more scientific, the whole thing, but still, that kernel of that idea is still with us.
What insights can we get from examining Tut's DNA, and what are the limitations of trying to piece together any kind of genetic profile of someone who's been dead for more than 3,000 years?
There's a variety of different things you can get from the DNA. So one is family relationships. So we do have other royal mummies from his time. So you can do genetic fingerprinting on them and try and look at, you know, make a family tree. And an attempt at that has been made. You can also look at broader sort of ethnic origins. You know, where did the pharaohs come from? You know, what kind of ethnic group was Tutankhamun? There's been a lot of interest in that. You can also look for the the presence of bacterial infections and that kind of thing. But the study that was done most recently, it was published in 2010, so by an Egyptian team funded by the Discovery Channel, so they did their documentary, that was making a family tree of Tutankhamun and his relatives. And they concluded that the anonymous pharaoh that we mentioned that was found nearby was Akhenaten, and that he was Tutankhamun's father. It concluded that the two fetuses were probably Tutankhamun's daughters. They weren't sure about that, but they thought probably, and there were a fair few sort of, you know, they did a whole five-generation family tree out of it, which is really fascinating. But other experts in the ancient DNA field were very skeptical of the whole thing because they didn't believe that actually any DNA survived at all in these mummies. You know, they're kept in hot conditions, heat destroys DNA, so they didn't believe that there was any DNA after 3,000 years, and that actually this study that had been done, they had just been fooled by contamination with modern DNA. They were just picking up human DNA from people who have handled the mummies in modern times. So there was a big argument about that. So yeah, it's incredible. You know, if you pick up some DNA, how do you know if it comes from the mummy or if it comes from Howard Carter, say, or somebody else who has handled a mummy? You know, even if you take precautions now, people who've handled mummies in the past didn't, so they were handling the mummy with their bare hands. DNA will have got onto them. So, yeah, that has been quite a big dispute within the scientific field.
When you went to the site of the tomb itself, was there anything that, having done all this research, that took you by surprise, given that what you had learned, anything that you hadn't maybe noticed the first time?
I think I was just, he's so frail, the mummy, because, you know, this persona of King Tut, it's just this huge thing, and it's used to advertise and market things. You know, it's the golden mask is so familiar. You know, we know about the treasures, and so we imagine this big, awesome, golden king, you know, one of the most famous figures from history. And then you go, and you see this frail, black figure. I mean, he's thick, thin, the limbs. I mean, so he's got a sort of beige kind of linen covering over him, but you can see the skull and you can see the feet and you can see that there's barely anything underneath the sheet. There's just hardly anything there. It's just a shadow, really. And that was quite moving, really. I mean, he's just I said to the guard that was in there with me, because he obviously spent a lot of time with him, I was like, you know, what do you think of him? And he just said, you know, he's just a boy. And that's really what you get when you see the mummy itself. And I think it's easy to, you sort of see the human mortal boy, and it's easy to forget that sometimes when you see all the other stuff around King Tut.
Do you think we would care so much about him if we knew everything about him?
No, I don't think we would, because I think we would just tick the boxes and move on. You know, we'd have our answers. I think it's because he's so mysterious. You know, everything we find out about him just opens up further questions, and I think that's fascinating. But it also allows different groups of people to see whatever they like in him. So many claims have been made about Tutankhamun. You know, there's this whole argument over his ethnic ancestry. You know, was he black? Was he white? You know, he gets used as this sort of poster child. Everybody wants to sort of own King Tut. And it's hard to prove people wrong because we know so little.
The new book by Jo Marchant is called The Shadow King, The Bizarre Afterlife of King Tut's Mummy. Jo, it's been a fascinating hour. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy, with the podcast produced by Christine McConnell. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer, and Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can download the podcast free at kera.org/think and send emails to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.